Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most daring, dangerous, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons learned through their experience. I'm Phil, here with Brian, your host, and we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association. All right, guys, we got a good one for you today. Our first guest, that's not me and Brian, just spitballing here. We have the man, the myth, the legend on the phone. Tim Woody. I'm going to go ahead and introduce this hero and servant of the nation for over 20 years. He joined back in 1995, 6 days before Christmas. First assignment was a Coast Guard cutter, the mighty Courageous out of Panama City. Went from there to a Stant, which is up in Michigan. Probably hated Aton, got out of there as quick as he could, headed to Station Hoyo River up in Fort Bragg, California, where he certified as a surfman. And then, you know, I had the pleasure of meeting him at Station Golden Gate in California in 2004, where he was a bosun mate first class. Graduated from the ground pounders to the officer in charge of Station Ashtabula up in Ohio. Went on to come back to Golden Gate because he loved the punishment as the executive officer, and left there and as a bosun warrant, and became a commanding officer at Station Fire Island, New York. Final assignment was some cushy sector office gig that apparently he just couldn't sit still long enough, so he ended up pretty much taking over leadership of the Coast Guard's operational risk management program, or a lot of facets of it, up at our training center in Petaluma. He's taught at the Boat Forces Command Cadre College. He's taught at the training center in Yorktown. That's the session point for all bosun mates. And personal note, I will say, you know, having been with Mr. Woody or Tim for a period of 3 or 4 years, you know, there's a few guys out there that you would you'd launch on any case with and never have a single reservation about how things are going to go, that everybody's going to make it back. And if there's any potential that you could save somebody or, you know, could bring some bad guy down, this is the kind of guy that you wanted on the boat with you. So it's a huge pleasure to have you here, Mr. Woody. I'll go ahead and let you say, you know, just kind of intro yourself. Did I miss anything?
Nah, man, you, that was, I don't know, I'm humbled that you said all that stuff about me in nice words. And, you know, honestly, having been out of the Coast Guard game for 4 years or so, I'll be honest with you, man, I don't miss a lot. I don't miss pounding out on the ocean. But there are a lot of people that I really enjoyed being with. And, you know, the people is what makes the organization, man, not any of us individually. It's just us as a collective team working together, doing the missions, whether it's support or operational. So I just want to say I think it's awesome that you and Brian are doing this podcast, and I think more people should get into the world of podcasting because it's a great way to tell stories and get a message out. So thanks for having me on, man. I'm humbled.
Well, Mr. Woods, we've never met, but I would love to have served with you as Phil did.
I don't think he's up to the task, personally.
Me? Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So let's just jump right into this. Give us your most dangerous, epic, and daring story or stories. I'm sure you have more than one.
Yeah, so I talked to Phil a couple days ago, and I didn't need long to think about it because I have one story that has stuck with me. It's kind of haunted me for a long time. Never been able to get out of my head, and it's a story of humility. You guys know more than anybody that nothing is more humbling than the ocean, right?
Correct.
The ocean will expose all of your flaws. It will expose all of your weaknesses. It will expose your lack of training. It will expose any human factor that can potentially cause a mishap. So that's the story. This was probably 2000, had to be circa 2003. I was only a surfman for maybe less than 6 months, and I'd just taken over as the executive petty officer, which is the second command of Coast Guard Station Noya River, which is nestled just in Northern California, a little sea town just south of the Oregon border.
Hey, real quick, for those that don't know, surfman, let's hear a surfman's take on it. What highest level boat driver, what would you tell the audience about being a surfman?
Yeah, you know what I'd say about being a surfman? You know, I think it's a little bit about boat driving and, technical expertise, heavy weather search and rescue, heavy weather operations, being able to operate a vessel in the surf zone to effect a rescue. But honestly, man, and I had a mentor tell me this in 2001. He said that being a surfman is about 10% boat driving, 90% how you carry yourself. And that's always stuck with me, man. I think it's more than just boat driving. It's decision making and maturity, all those things that go into having the responsibility of operating out in the ocean in an extreme condition. So, yeah, I mean, they named it surfing. It goes all the way back to the life-saving service, walking the beaches with lanterns, and shipwrecks hit the beach, and the surfmen were there to send up the flares, the Coskin flares. So it's deep tradition in Coast Guard history, and I'm just proud to be one of them.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Back to the story.
Was that a terrible?
No, that was good. You know, I was actually picturing you like walking the beach. I don't think I ever saw you walk the beach with a Coskin flare, but I can see it.
You gotta think about those people back then, man. You know, we have all the great survival suits and equipment nowadays that, man, they're walking around with slicks on and rain gear and. You know, back in the early 1900s, man, it's pretty amazing what they did, you know?
Let's remember, I used to remember, like, you know, we moored our boats up to the dock, right? And you would be like, hey, take off lines. And sometimes I was like, man, this is, on a crappy day, right? Like, I don't even want to take off the line. I couldn't imagine if we were out on the beach and you're like, hey, hitch up the boat and bring it down to the surf line. Like,
push it in the water.
Yeah, throw it in the water.
I couldn't imagine. Honestly, one of the proudest things I did when I was at Fire Island, my crew, we stood up, we did a surf boat reenactment at the lighthouse on Fire Island, which was probably one of the coolest things my crew and I had ever done. So anyways, yeah, that's the surfman lore, I guess.
Very cool. I like it. We'll perpetuate the lore on here.
Perfect. So, you guys ready to get back into this?
Yeah, let's get back into the story.
Okay, so yeah, I'm at Station Noya River. I've been there, been the XPO or second in command, executive petty officer for literally probably less than 6 months. And we had gotten into the heart of crab season on the Pacific coast. And this was in California. So you guys know fishing boats, and you know they have a livelihood to do. At the time that this story happened, I had just taken over temporarily as the officer in charge because my boss, the one who had command of the unit, went on leave. So I was running the unit. I'd been in E6 for maybe a year and a half and been, like I said, XPO for less than 6 months, if that. And he went on leave, and it was one of those afternoons where I knew we had a kind of a storm coming in, and I knew there was a lot of crab boats out on the ocean.
Yeah, and these are all Dungeness crab, right? Like they're Dungeness crab fishing boats. So they got the pots on the back when they launch out. They're already kind of unstable. Yeah, I got you. What do you think? Like 40 plus feet or so, most of them?
Yeah, they're anywhere from 30 feet to 50 feet. The bulk of the ones that were in Fort Bragg, mostly wooden boats. We're talking 15 years ago. So we had a pretty significant crabbing fleet out of Fort Bragg at the time. And like you said, man, these guys are out on the ocean and essentially they're already taking on water because they have a live well that they're throwing the crab in.
Yep.
So it's already a boat that may have some stability issues, and if it's not very seaworthy, it can be a very dangerous mission. And then, like you said, with all the crab pots on the back and all that kind of stuff.
And then the Noya River bar. So you said the weather conditions were already kind of deteriorating. Does the bar break all the way across?
Yeah. So a little bit about the Noya River bar, man. It's and if, for the listeners, if no one, I mean, mean, people may not know what a bar is, as it applies to the Pacific Ocean. The bars on the West Coast, when we talk about basically where the river meets the Pacific Ocean, it's where the currents dissipate, you get sandy deposits, and the sea conditions change can change rapidly when the Pacific Ocean meets a river. So the Noyo River in particular, the entrance where it meets the Pacific is extremely narrow. I think from one jetty, from South Jetty to North Jetty, less than 100 feet, maybe somewhere in there.
Yeah.
You know, where some of the bars on the West Coast, you know, maybe a mile wide, 2 miles wide. Ours was, I think, about a little less than 100 feet. And rock jetties on both sides.
Shooting the gap. That's shooting the gap.
So when it breaks all the way across.
Yeah, it's going to break all the way across, especially once you get into the winter when you have a west swell. Because the entrance to Noyo River was basically running due west, due east, 270-090.
Yeah.
So in the wintertime, when the swell shifted from northwest to west, that's when we got to experience most of the breaking surf on the bar. And there's just no room for error, man. Even in the summertime, you know, if you're towing in a sailboat and you have a 3-foot rolling swell on the bar, you know, we had to drogue a lot of the sailboats or put a drogue on the back. It's like a big parachute, right? This slows the boat down.
Yep.
Helps with stability. It was even in the summertime, it was hairy towing a boat across that bar. It was dangerous, man.
Yeah.
365 days a year, man, it was sketchy coming in and out of that place.
Good.
But anyways, so yeah, I knew the storm was coming. So what I did is, it's probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I got in the government vehicle by myself and just drove up to the South Bluff. It's about a 100-foot cliff that I can see the whole Noyo River bar, the entrance, all the way out to the Pacific, to the horizon, right? So I'm looking north. And as I gaze to the northwest towards the horizon, I see a line of halogen lights, and I knew they were racing towards the sea buoy, right? So I knew they were trying to beat this swell before, because the swell was coming. It was imminent. This big westerly swell was coming. And the predictions, I think, were somewhere between, I don't know, man, 14 feet, 16-foot west swell. And I'm not trying to, like, and I'm trying not to tell, like, a fish story where the seas get bigger every time I tell it. So, and I think, Phil, you brought this up on your intro, man, like, over time, you lose pieces of the story. So, you know, so you guys, yeah, Brian, you know this, man. You said, I'm trying not to fill it in with, like, BS. Does that make sense?
So, it's all right.
Yeah, no,
it's so expected. Anyways, that's why I put the warning in there.
Yeah, right. I'd say, we had this conversation 10 years from now, it'd be a 30-foot swell.
Yeah, absolutely. 30-foot swell, 4 million boats. The gap was only 40 feet.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, but I think it was 14 to 16 foot, which a 14-foot swell, man, coming into the Noyo River Bar was extremely dangerous, man, just because you have no room for error.
Yeah, and the halogen lights you talked about, those are all the deck lights on the fishing boats. So you saw the entire fleet basically turning toward the entrance saying, hey,
steaming,
we're getting
back home, right?
Yeah.
Oh, man, you could just – when I saw that, I had the weather report, National Weather Service report in my hand, and I looked up, and, I mean, man, the amount – it was – and I just – my stomach dropped because I knew what was about to happen, right? I knew they were racing for the Noyo River entrance, and it was – man, it was just the whole horizon was lit up with halogen lights. And some of these boats may have been out of Fort Bragg. They may have been out of Humboldt Bay, which is to the north. They could have been out of San Francisco. But I knew they were coming to Fort Bragg. So what I did was I essentially, you know, the bluff where I was at was about a 5-minute ride back to the Coast Guard station. I took the GV back to the Coast Guard station. And what I did was I talked to my crew that was on duty there at the time. And my first thought was, we have to launch 247s, 247-foot motor lifeboats, which still is our Coast Guard's main surf rescue platform. And I was going to go out there and act as a surf heavy weather standby as these boats try to come across the river. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you were going to take one, right? You're in charge that day, and you're going to launch out on the boat.
Yeah, yep. I think at the time, man, we were extremely short people, and if I remember right, I was actually standing duty as well. So if you think from a command and control function, probably not super cool that the XPO is first boat surfman, standing duty, but yet acting as the officer in charge.
Actually, you are acting CO.
I think it's super cool.
At the time.
Hey, if you're gonna leave from anywhere, leave from the fight, right? Like out in the storm. So perfect.
Yeah, man, it was looking back and after all risk management, you know, it's easy to hindsight quarterback that scenario, which is what I'm doing. But, yeah, man, it wasn't ideal conditions, though, from a command and control perspective and trying to have the big picture, right? But I did the best I could, and as our crew did. So fast forward a few hours, and it was getting dark, probably around 5, 6 o'clock or whatever. I think the other surfman was recalled. I think he lived probably less than 10 minutes from the station. So my goal was to have 2 47-foot motor lifeboats, potentially one outside the bar in the ocean, like towards the sea buoy, and then one inside the bar on the river in case something happened as we were crossing the bar. So that's the stage so far. Is the big picture coming together?
Sounds good. I see it.
Okay, so like I said, fast forward about 2.5 hours, we launched 247s. Before we launched, we had a kind of a quick brief of kind of what we were planning to do, what the goal was. And I look back on this, I'm like, what was our goal? Well, I guess our goal was to prevent something bad happening as a boat was trying to come across the bar, to kind of be a bird's eye view about sea conditions, what 147 was seeing on the bar as far as surf conditions, and relaying that to the fishing boats via radio, VHF radio on channel, I think we're on 21 or whatever, 22 probably, 22. So I think there was maybe, by the time the boat started getting the sea buoy, I think there was maybe 10 fishing boats, maybe 12. It was somewhere in that number. And I remember as soon as they started hitting the sea buoy, they were coming in. But I think one of the biggest things that stands out for me, things that I'll never forget, was as we were leaving the station and we made the turn from the bend of Noyo River and headed towards the entrance of the ocean, one thing I'll never forget was the sound. If you hear surf like that, it sounded like a freight train, man. Yeah. And I will never forget that day. Honestly, and this was at night. We were pitch dark, right? Pitch dark by the time I hit the Noyo River bar to do the standbys. No moonlight, no stars, no nothing, just darkness.
Scary. And scariest sound you can probably hear, right? Can't see the surf. All I can do is hear it destroying some rocks over there. Yeah, I get it. That's bad.
Man, and I'll tell you, this was maybe, I think, my second surf case.
Holy cow.
And I say case, I mean, like, no one was hurt, right? We weren't going out to save a life. This was just going out to hopefully do something to prevent something bad from happening. That was in our mindset. And like, we've done this for a long time, going out and being, you know, standbys for heavy weather and stuff like that.
Yeah, and a lot of times, I mean, if you called in, you know, if a guy had trouble getting across, hopefully, you know, you said there were like a 12-boat fleet trying to make it in. If guy number one doesn't make it and then you guys are there, you can kind of shut down the rest, right? Like, don't.
We had no authority to do that. Because,
yeah, you couldn't legally shut it down, but you could be like, hey, this is a bad call, guys. Guy number one didn't make it. How about we just ride it out?
Yes. And I think towards the end of that night, that was kind of like what I was saying. And by this time, I was saying on channel 16.
Yeah.
I highly, strongly recommend no one else come in. Right. It's kind of doing the circle of the sea buoy for, you know, at least until daylight hit. You know, but then again, you got this, you know, the crabbers, they have catch on board and they want to get this catch in. So
that's
money.
It's
their livelihood.
Yep. That's
so,
money.
Yeah.
And, hey, I know, Tim, like a lot of surf units too, you know, when you have a breaking bar, I don't know, Noyo River's pretty narrow, but I know like up in Cape Disappointment, they'll kind of like take the force of the wave, right? Like wave blocking almost for traffic as it comes in. Was that part of the plan, or was that could it not happen because the entrance is too narrow?
Yeah, my plan was once, because I made the decision that I was going to, myself and my boat crew, we were going to actually cross the bar and head out to the sea buoy and try to rendezvous with the first fishing vessel, just to kind of see what they were thinking. And, you know, I guess my thought process is once they were going in, if they were going to try to go in, I was going to get off plate, position myself off their stern. I may have been able to knock some seas down, but basically if I had a large wave coming underneath me, I wanted to be able to relay that to the fishing vessel in front of me as he was heading east towards the river. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it makes perfect. And just, I believe, like, if you listen to my story, just the Coast Guard being on scene will give these fishermen a lot more confidence and a calming effect when they know they're about to embark on something pretty dangerous.
Yeah, Brian, that's a great point. I think that was part of our mindset as well, as not only try to give the perspective of what we were seeing on the boat, which might raise their confidence level, but also hearing what kind of perspective they had.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back, I mean, you got to figure a lot of those gentlemen that were running those boats, they may have been in and out of the Know Your River Bar 20, 30, or 50 times.
Right.
You know, so they probably had as much experience, probably more, way more experience than I ever had crossing that bar in the surf.
Yeah, most fishermen do.
Yeah, man, a lot of those guys are super salty and gals. There's a lot of fishermen on the East Coast too. It's just tough, man. It was we were in a situation that I felt like I put our boat crew in to do this standby, and I don't necessarily know in hindsight if we did the best move as far as actually going out into the ocean. And that's kind of where this story kind of turns for me. As I crossed the bar and went out with our boat crew, I realized real quick that being in pitch darkness in the surf was, I mean, until you're in the surf in pitch dark, I mean, there's just this sinking feeling. Like, it is fear, man. Like, for me, it was.
Yeah.
I was scared, man. Like, I was like, you know, in the sounds, and you can't see anything until you actually hit a wave. And then as I got maybe halfway towards the sea buoy, the other visual that I will never forget was the lights of Fort Bragg, the little town, getting drowned out by a wave that passed underneath me.
Yeah.
And that was between the sound of the surf and the town getting drowned out by the swell as it passed underneath me. I knew it was fairly big seas that were coming across. And it's just, man, you try to hold a course on your compass, because I knew it was 270 straight to the buoy. And we had a range light behind us that the lookout from behind could tell me if I was south of course, on course, or north of course. So that's kind of where I'm at in this story now. I'm heading out towards the sea buoy, and I've taken three or four really big breaks close to the bar, and I just started to get closer to the sea buoy where it started to, the rollers, it was more rollers than surf. So I'll pause there if you guys have any questions of where I'm at. So
yeah, so hey, I got one. So was that the first time in the surf at night? Because I know in general we don't train in surf at night.
I don't think you're allowed to train
at night. Probably not, right?
I'm pretty sure.
For that very reason.
Yeah, man, that was my first time in the surf at night. It wasn't my last time. I'd only been in the surf, by the time I retired, maybe just a handful of times. But that was the first time I was in the surf at night. The other surfman that was on the other 47-foot motor lifeboat, he was far more seasoned than I was. So looking back, I mean, you know, he may have been a better better choice to head across the bar if we needed to send someone across the bar. But I was one of those things where I was like, you know what, I kind of made this decision, we're going to come out here, and I'm, you know, and my crew, there was little pushback from my crew, and we did it, man. And you know, I was lucky just to make it across the bar and stay in the channel, let alone coming back in. Because I knew once the scariest thing for me is once I knew I got across,
you gotta come
I knew
back.
I'd come back in.
Yeah, right, for sure. We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
And you couldn't see anything behind you, man. Like, one thing we did have, one of the tools we did have in our kit, you guys know this, haven't been on 47s, is that you have 127, you have parachute flares, right? Illumination flares?
Yep.
So out of the corner, this whole event took place maybe over 2 or 3 hours, maybe two. Like I said, this is one of those things where, you know, your concept of time changes, obviously. But I think between two 47-foot motor lifeboats and the beach crew I had up on the bluff, I think over the whole night we may have launched upwards of close to 25 to 30 127 parachute flares.
Yeah,
wow.
As these boats are trying to come in. And, I mean, and it was one of those things where the illumination flares are great until they go out.
Right.
sir, you were illuminating the bar, right? You were illuminating the bar so the fishing boats could see the surf, correct?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. So the 47-foot lifeboat, the crew that was inside the river, that was stationed inside the river, as I knew that a fishing boat was crossing, making the crossing, what I told our boat crew in the river and cliff, I said, just keep the bar lit, right? So it's just one. So those parachute flares, those illumination flares last around 30 seconds, 36 seconds, whatever, give or take. So my guidance was basically keep the bar lit, right? Keep, and those things are bright.
Oh, yeah.
So it was just one flare after another, man, trying to go up, and you try to light the next flare off before the one before it extinguishes. So that was probably the best help that night. But after a certain point, I think a few fishing boats made it in safely, and I was trying to station keep between the river and the sea buoy. Out to the sea buoy is about a mile run, right, from the entrance all the way out to the sea buoy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to station keep about a half mile, about exactly in between, and I could not stay on course, man. I could not stay on course. And this is where, like, it probably got really sketchy, and to this day, I'm probably glad it was at night, because I don't know how close I was to running aground on the rocks on the south side. But at one point, I knew that we were dangerously south of the channel, and I kept getting hit with these swells, and I could not. It was one of those, it's almost like got this vertigo feeling, you know, where you just get a little disoriented because the swells are coming in so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so pitch dark in between, like, when the flares are going up. And my crew is telling me, we're south of the channel. And finally, man, I somehow got back on course. And it was at that moment that I knew that I had to get back in, man. I had to get back inside. And I'll be honest with you guys, man, I didn't care what these fishing boats were doing from then on out. I had to get back inside the river, man, to keep my crew safe.
Right, yeah.
Because I truly felt, man, that I was on the verge of killing my entire boat crew. And that, to this day, man, and it's like, when I talk about it, it's haunting, man, thinking about it. So I was able to get back inside of the river. It's one of those things where I wish I had a Fitbit on back then to see what my heart rate was.
Yeah, right.
But needless to say, man, we made it in safely. Between my boat crew and the other 47, there was a lot of fishing boats that decided to stay out by the buoy. Thankfully, they decided to just wait it out, and they decided it wasn't worth it. And we got back home safely, man. But I'll never forget that night going home, and I couldn't sleep, man. I laid in bed for hours, man, just thinking about kind of how dumb that might have been. You know, I was trying to do the right thing and doing the standby, but I don't know in hindsight if it was, you know, we could have both 47s could have potentially stayed inside the river, you know, and maybe accomplished the same goal. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but like you said, to armchair quarterback on the decision that was made, it's easy to do that now. I can say I can say the same thing about a number of even life events, not just Coast Guard. That I can armchair quarterback. So,
but yeah, I mean, you know, I'm thinking too. Like, you know, you're on a 47 foot motor lipo, right? Like, and we all know, and you know, for the audience's sake, that is the toughest boat I think you could be on, right? I mean, that if you're on that boat, you automatically have a little more confidence, a little more risk acceptance, I think, because you know that you have you believe in the boat. The boat's gonna bring you home. But like you said, when you get disoriented out there, the one thing that boat can't survive is a brush with some rocks, you know, or some shoals. So. You know, that'll end your day real quick, especially in that kind of intense surf. So I get it. I can totally, you know, I can imagine that disoriented feeling and realizing, like, hey, I'm jeopardizing myself and more importantly, everybody else on here.
Yeah. It's not just your life you got in your hands. It's your whole entire crew. And that does weigh heavy on you. I'm sure your adrenaline was, when you got back to the station, your adrenaline was going so, was just out of the, you know, I'm not surprised you couldn't sleep at all.
Yeah.
Man, it was, I had a ton of adrenaline. When that adrenaline dump happened, man, it was like, dude, I was exhausted for days after that, man. Mentally exhausted, physically exhausted. Phil, you said it, man, the 47 is a great platform. The lifeboat's a great platform. It's agile, it's quick, it's responsive. I mean, it's super buoyant, right? It gets knocked around pretty easy.
Do you find that it rides better in a little, like, I've always found that it literally, the ride is better in a little bit of weather than it is, like, if it was flat-ass qualm.
Yeah, I mean, it handled really well, man. I've never had an issue of how the thing rides. I mean, good throttle management, even in the surf, it's, it handles very well. And, I mean, you're going to still take a pounding, but, yeah, riding, especially over swells and stuff, it's super responsive. So I've enjoyed the 47. I first got qualified on it in 1999. And,
was that hole number one?
Is that the one that they painted white?
Yeah. No, this was actually, they called it the Triple Deuce, man. 47222 was its call sign.
Nice.
Never
cool.
Forget it.
Yeah, very cool. Remember the 292?
What's that?
Do you remember the 292?
I do remember the
292. Yeah, man, the sector spare. What a piece of trash, huh? Yeah. It still gets you home, but man, that thing was abused.
That thing made its rounds. But yeah, man, back to the story. I think, you know, if you could dive into the world of risk management, one, we talk about human factors, right? What are the human factors that can lead to a mishap, right? And most of our mishaps in the Coast Guard are human error driven, right? Human error. This was a night, one of those human factors we talked about is called pressing, right? Where you feel this sense of urgency to do something, and maybe it's not as urgent as you think it is, right?
Right.
And how many search and rescue cases have we, you know, we gotta go, when maybe we could have paused a minute, getting some more information, whatever. That was definitely a night where I may have pressed too much. Like I said, hindsight, right? I got hindsight bias I'm working with. But yeah, pressing, and it's caused many a mishaps, man.
Yeah, I'll say, you know, you remember the Potato Patch Shoal in off San Fran, right? Just north of the entrance.
I do. I remember staring at that in the lighthouse for hours with you doing a heavy weather tow one.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember, I remember doing a nighttime surf crossing down there with the executive petty officer at the time. And I remember, you know, I was still young and dumb, so I didn't know, right? I didn't know the kind of danger we were in. I knew that I was pretty puckered. But when we got back, his reaction was, I think, pretty similar to yours, right? Like, the weight of it just kind of came down on him that, man, that was probably a little over my capability, the boat's capabilities, and the need, right?
Yeah.
I felt that from him. And he actually, you know, he talked to all of us about it. Pretty much a very similar story to what you just told, a very similar reaction to what you just told. But, you know, to kind of bring it down to the listeners, you know, the name of this podcast is They Had to Go Out, right? How do you shore up that press, right, that we all feel, right? Because we're those kind of people that we press to go out. We feel like we have to go. We want to go. How do you shore up that need to press with the need to make the right call? You know, to maybe make the call that says, "Hey, we're not going to go today, or we're gonna find a different option."
Yeah, and I'll apply your question to the story I just told. I should have took way more feedback. I think we got maybe locked into this this groupthink bubble, right, where I was kind of dictating what I thought we should do, and the other thing I think that made me press was I felt this other weight of being in charge of the unit, right? So right. Not wanting to let my boss down. Like, I had all of these things, and I'm not making excuses for why we launched or whatever, but I had all these, like, factors weighing heavily on me, and I should have sunk it. We had plenty of time to go out there. We had at least 3 or 4 hours to plan this. I think our planning was inadequate, looking back on it. I think the planning could be better, and I should have gotten more feedback from the surfman that was more seasoned, right, that had more experience, had probably done this before, like up in Humboldt or wherever, Humboldt Bay. I just felt like I had to be the one making decisions, and being junior at the time in the Coast Guard and in a first class, that need to feel like you have to be the one making decisions is dangerous, man, when you apply it to heavy weather search and rescue. You know, whether it's the heavy weather coxswain or the surfman that has like a macho attitude that's like, oh, it's going to be my way or the highway, or it's just someone that feels compelled to have to make decisions because they're thrown in this world of being in charge, and they have to be the one to make the decision. So there were other options. I mean, there were, and I just, whether I didn't listen to them or I was just had such tunnel vision that, you know, I don't know. It hasn't been so, you know, we're talking 15 years ago now. I can't remember specifics of conversations.
Yeah.
But I felt like it was a very hasty decision to launch, and I don't think there was a lot of pushback like, hey, Tim or Petty Officer Woody, like, this is a really dumb idea, dude, to cross the bar. I don't remember any of those conversations. If they were, maybe I just didn't listen to them. But
what about during the debrief? Was there anything, like, did anybody raise anything during the debrief, or were they all, like, high-fiving? Because I remember during that, you know, that night when I was talking about it, I think we all came back and we high-fived, except for the guy who felt the weight of responsibility, right?
It wasn't a lot of debrief going on back then.
Yeah, that's
either.
Also true.
You know, there wasn't. I mean, now we can look at it and say lessons learned, you know. Even though you beat yourself up and criticize yourself about decisions you made, you can actually chalk it up as something, a learning point. And I believe later on in your career, you actually went on to teach other people about this. So
I did. I mean, I'll be out, Brian, Phil, now I'll be completely honest with you. Full disclosure, man. When I was inside the river safely, and our crew was safely made it back in the river, no other fishing boats were coming in, I don't remember anything from that point on until I was home. Like, the next memory I have of that event was being laying in bed. So I honestly, man, I think I had so much adrenaline going, and I had experienced, like, terrifying fear, man, like the fear that you may not live.
Yeah,
that was the fear I had at certain points that night, man, or like the fear that I may potentially be responsible for killing my boat crew, man. I thought about that. There was multiple times out on the ocean that I thought about that, and it stuck with me, man. And like I said, so once I got back, I don't remember a debrief.
Yeah,
I don't even remember if I moored the boat up to the pier. If someone else did it. I knew I did. I did have one other surfman on the boat with me, who at the time I believe he was not recertified yet. He came from another unit, and he was the one that was launching off the illumination flares from the port side of the open bridge as I was driving from the starboard side of the right side.
Right.
But I'll be honest with you guys, I do not remember a debrief, man. So,
I believe it.
Well,
yeah, I believe it.
Adrenaline is the best drug there is, they say. So, you don't remember anything.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a pretty timely story, right? Because, you know, I don't remember what harbor they were coming into, but, you know, they just had a fishing boat roll in the surf up there, and I think three fishermen's lives were lost. So,
yeah, it was actually a vessel from the that crab boat.
Yeah, Yaquina Bay, I think. So I'm pretty sure it was Yaquina Bay. I don't know if you saw that, Tim, but, you know, just to illustrate the danger, right? I mean, the danger is real. That was, I think the weight of responsibility that you had is very, you know, it was a real realization.
It's true. It's true. That's the.
Yeah. You know what? In part of the being at nighttime and pitch black, I was probably one of the good things about that is I probably didn't realize visually how close we were to meeting our demise or hitting a rock. I mean, there was, because of the cliffs, I mean, that just south of that channel was littered with huge rocks, man. And you guys have seen the Pacific Coast, man. We're in the crab season now, man, Washington and Oregon. And I actually, as I tell this story, man, I'm in an overlook looking out in the Pacific Ocean, and I see multiple halogen lights from fishing vessels. And it's pretty calm today, you know, in the Pacific up here near Cape Disappointment. But, yeah, man, it's a dangerous profession, both the search and rescue side of our Coast Guard and the fishing side, man, of the men and women who are operating these fishing vessels and trying to make a living, man. It's a tough job, man. It's a dangerous job. Very dangerous.
Solid story. Awesome story, Tim. Thanks, we appreciate you for sharing it.
Yeah, no worries, man. It's like I said, sometimes I like talking about it, sometimes I don't. But, you know, if I can, you know, if anyone else can learn from the whole pressing thing and, you know, creating a sense of urgency when maybe there isn't one, if I could give one lesson to anybody who is in the world of response or whatever, it's sometimes the situation may not be as urgent as it seems. right?
Right.
And that's the importance of having a discussion, a solid brief before you go anywhere, making sure you have the big picture and making sure you are launching on any mission for the right reasons and not for the wrong ones.
For sure.
So
that's probably why old men like us tell stories to make sure the new guys have it. Because if you made it this long, you probably learned a few lessons the hard way, right?
Yeah, man. Experience is the best teacher, right?
For
and
sure.
Heuristically, there's no better experience than hands-on experience. Experience in the surf at night. I don't think there's a whole lot of surfmen that get it. But when you find yourself in the surf, in a surf zone at night on the Pacific Ocean, man, there's nothing that can prepare you for that, right? No amount of training, whatever, as you're coming up before you get certified to surf, and there's no amount of training that can train you for the first time you're in the surf at night. It's like using the force, man. I don't know how to explain it.
I know your head was on a swivel. You're like, I don't even know where I was, really. I'm sure your head was just on a swivel the whole time.
Hell, yeah, you doubt about it.
That was the biggest thing. I think the biggest thing I tried to do was keep the boat pointed due west or due east.
Yeah,
right.
You know? And I was just, I felt like we were in survival mode, man. Once I crossed the bar and was out in the ocean, I felt like I was of no help. Our boat crew was of no help other than the illumination flares to the fishing fleet.
Yeah.
Because I was in survival mode. So, anyways.
Hey, before we let you go, I have a question for you. So you were up in D9. You were up at Ashtabula, right?
Correct.
Did you ever get to ride an airboat?
You know, I did not, man.
Man.
I think my last year or two in Ashtabula, because I'm myself and my crew, we stood up our ice rescue program in Ashtabula.
Yeah.
So the first time I went to Saginaw River, where they had the ice rescue school, that was the first time I'd actually seen an airboat. And it had the whole Coast Guard electronics packages in it and everything, but I've never actually been on one.
All right. Well, for our listeners, I'm going to find you another airboat coxswain, and that one's coming one day, because we're talking about a sporty ride. I'd say night ops in the surf, airboat on plate ice. I think you're about at the same level of stupidity and danger there, for sure. Hey,
yeah,
Tim, is there anything that you what projects are you working on now? Anything that we could get the word out there for you about, or that you want people to know?
I just launched a new website. I'm working on a project that's in its infancy. It's called Leadosophy. Leadosophy.com is the website. It's the fusion of leadership and philosophy. So just a little bit, like once I left the Coast Guard, I went back to college. I got a degree in philosophy, and now I'm working. I'm going to school at Gonzaga, working on my master's degree in organizational leadership. But the whole time I was an undergrad in a philosophy program, I never understood why leadership was not like a subfield of philosophy. So, and I don't mean to get too deep in the academic weeds, but philosophy has a ton of subfields, and I can never get out of my head that why there wasn't a leadership subfield in philosophy. So I've tried to do that, man. I started a new website. It's called leadosophy.com. Check it out. It's just in its infancy, so don't be too harsh of a critic. But I'm going to try to expand that over the coming year or two.
Awesome, man. Hey, I encourage every listener, leadosophy.com. If I was going to, there's a reason that Tim's the first guest on this show.
Right.
And that's because he's a leader that that made an impact on me. And I'm sure that whatever product he's putting out there at leadosophy.com is solid. No doubts about it. So please check it out for him. And with that, Tim, hey, man, we so appreciate you coming on.
Tim, thank you so much for doing this for us, man. We really appreciate it.
Love the story, man. And
I
think we all took a lesson from it. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Maybe we'll do a follow-up episode, like episode 100. How's that sound?
For sure.
100 would be perfect.
Yeah. Hey, we got to look for, we're going to go from search and rescue to law enforcement. So start thinking about that law enforcement, security case, whatever. And we'll bring you back on and hear that. And I'm sure you got tons of others.
I'll defer the law enforcement stories to you, Phil.
Okay, cool enough. Hey, thanks again, Tim. We really appreciate it, man. Have a great day sitting out there on the point looking at the fishing fleet.
All right, Brian, Phil, I appreciate it, guys. And keep doing what you're doing, man. It's awesome work.
Thanks for taking the time.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up on social media and at theyhadtogooout.com.
Subscribe, like, comment, share, and review so we can keep this momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Be sure to look for our next episode.
Until then, fair winds and following seas.